The truest and easiest measure of the meaning of what makes a democracy is, for me, one simple rule. Can you insult your ruler? It sounds silly, but let's be honest, one of the great hallmarks of Britain and America and France and Germany and Canada and everywhere that calls itself a democracy is that you can, if you so desire, insult the person in charge of your country without penalty or punishment, using as colourful language as you can imagine. It's a privilege, I think, every citizen of every democracy does at least once in their lives. But it was not always so. In 1297, we have a powerful demonstration of this in London. England was in crisis. War was all-consuming, and the sheer costs of this massive series of wars was hitting many people personally and crippling the economy. In a tavern over to the east of the city of London, a man called William of Gloucester came in and, after a few drinks, began abusing the king's reputation. He pointed out of the tavern towards the nearby Tower of London. Atop the walls, upon a spike, was the decayed head of Llywelyn ap Gruffydd, the Welsh leader and recent victim of King Edward's wrath. The head was rotting away, and as per usual practice, it had been covered in tar to preserve it. There, atop the walls of the tower, Llywelyn's head would sit to allow all the enemies of the king know what their fate would be. But this William of Gloucester was certainly not intimidated. In that tavern, he pointed to the severed head and said that the king's head should be up there, beside it. This statement was overheard by another patron of the bar, a London goldsmith called John Paternoster, and he and his friends took umbrage at the insult, and so he and his friends beat William of Gloucester to death over the insult. Insulting the rulers of England back in the years leading up to the 1300s was clearly a dangerous thing to do. But it does beg the question, why was he insulting the king? What was going on? What were these all-consuming wars? And above all, how did London benefit from this? Hi, my name is Saul. You are listening to The Story of London, a podcast that tries to, in weekly parts, present the grand narrative and story of the greatest city in the world, at least in my opinion. Each week is supposedly standalone, a self-contained episode containing a little slice of life from London's history. But put together, they produce an incredibly long, and I mean incredibly long, story of this city. And I'm not kidding when I say it's incredibly long. Currently, the time frame from episode 1 to episode 106 is 72 hours or 3 days. But still, for those of you who have been with me this entire journey, or those who are just joining, I'd like to welcome you to this chapter of the story, where, to be honest, we're going to be covering a lot of what was going on elsewhere, away from London. We need to understand what those wars were and the economic impact it had and why it had a big impact to understand, well, how London was going to exploit this. Because in 1299, London pulled a flanker. And so, without any further ado, grab a coffee, get comfortable, and welcome to chapter 107 of The Story of London. The Great Blag of 1299. The years 1296 to about 1300 are years known as an era of great crisis for King Edward I. The reason for this was the fact that there were three wars all going on at roughly the same time. King Edward was at war with France, and that led to surprisingly complicated campaigns down in Gascony and up in Flanders, and involved naval battles and land battles, and yeah, that was a thing. Meanwhile, the king faced a rebellion in Wales, and that involved sieges and nasty small-scale insurgency fighting, and yeah, that was also a thing. And of course, there was a war in Scotland, and that war would eventually be portrayed very, very badly in the film Braveheart, the war against John Balliol and then William Wallace, and that was a heck of a thing. And I had, when planning these episodes, done loads of research on all these wars, exciting and epic tales of daring do around the castles in North Wales, or the cold winter climate of the British North, or the sun-kissed fields of Gascony. But the problem is, none of these locations are London. And this podcast is supposed to be, well, you know, the story of London. So, with all those copious notes, yeah, I'm going to summarise them like a bad boy. Really simplify stuff and explain them all nice and dramatically, and just inform you now, before we begin, dear listener, that my version of these events do not do them justice. In fact, they do not even come close to explain away how staggeringly complex these events were, nor cover the incredible amounts of detail I'll be missing out on. But I'm just going to start with, out of all these events, which one was bothering London the most? And I hate to say it, the thing that was bothering London the most was cash. Because wars cost money. Money is the sinew of war. No money, no armies and no fleets. And without them, no war. And as such, we need to use London to examine the sinews of war itself, because they are very important. These wars imposed a huge strain upon the English state in Edward I's latter years. The cost of paying wages to the soldiers, of collecting sufficient food supplies to feed his armies, a staggering cost of building and then maintaining fleets, these were crippling. And then add to that that during this era, fear of invasion of France and actual invasion from Scotland forced the state to spend money to create a system of home defence. And all of this cost more money and placed not just a financial burden upon the state, but also upon the not very sophisticated, really administrative infrastructure of this nation. And now the paradox about this. These wars crippled England, and yet compared to later wars coming up fairly soon, the forces involved were never really large. None of the armies involved was ever more than about 30,000 strong, and they were also, by later standards, appallingly badly equipped. So why did this particular series of wars hurt the English economy so badly? Well, bottom line, there were very little surplus wealth in the economy which could be diverted to pay for them, and the yields of the harvests were needed to feed the population, most of whom raked out a day-to-day existence at subsistence level. The total amount of money in circulation in England was small in comparison with more modern periods. It was probably just around £1 million, and set against that, the cost of the wars of the 1290s was incredibly high. Edward I had an extremely difficult challenge facing him between 1294 and 1298. He had to organise all of this, collect huge taxes, and then persuade his subjects that his policies were the right ones to follow. And as we saw from the story at the beginning of this episode, he was not succeeding. In fact, Edward would fail in this. By 1297, his armies were basically too small, his revenues were basically inadequate, and his people were seething and potentially close to rebellion. Why? Well, my personal theory is that with the trusted advisors who had served him for so long dying, as I covered last episode, and a new guard coming up, Edward's sure-footed brutality began to falter. He began to make mistakes. Let me give you an example. In 1294, just as the war was starting to escalate, Edward realised he needed cash fast. Rather than summon a large parliament with full representation from the shires, the boroughs and the clergy, Edward instead called a smaller group of 62 barons to discuss the problems he's faced. And its sole purpose was to raise cash as fast as possible. And this smaller group did come up with some, well, interesting ideas. The sheriffs of England were immediately asked to organise the seizure of all the wool in England, supposedly as to prevent it from being exported to France. But that wasn't the actual reason. The real purpose soon became clear. This smaller group of 62 barons had agreed to a plan whereby all the wool would be seized by the crown, and then the crown would export it and sell it at what they hoped would be a very substantial profit. Oh, they did promise they would repay the people they took the wool from. Eventually, as you can imagine, this project met with fierce hostility from anybody involved in the wool trade. They all scrambled around and came up with alternative schemes for the king to do. And one of them was that rather than just seizing all the wool, what the king should do is create a massive customs duty at the rate of 5 marks, or £3, 3 shillings and 4 pence, on every sack of wool. Such a tax, unlike the straight seizure of the wool, would not put the merchants out of business, and it would be possible for them to pass on the burden of it to, you know, the growers in the form of lower prices and the consumers in the form of higher prices. The suggestion was a tempting one and was supported by the largest English wool merchants of the time. On July 26th of that year, therefore, the seizure of wool was cancelled. And 3 days later, officials were appointed to collect the new customs duties, which were set at 5 marks for a sack of high-quality sorted wool and 3 marks from an ordinary sack of wool. And yeah, this differential rate proved impossible to enforce, and it was not long before 3 marks, or 40 shillings, became the standard rate of customs on all wool being sold. Figures for receipts were not complete, but over £110,000 was collected between 1294 and late 1297, when the tax was abolished. This was an unpopular move, but it was a better version than the previous dumber unpopular move. More evidence of the king losing his sure-footing way of handling things? Well, he was cutting ties and changing up his personal finances, which also had an impact upon the state's finances. He broke faith with his Italian bankers, you see. As we've covered in previous episodes, since before he took the throne, King Edward had been closely involved with the Italian banking house of Riccardi of Lucca, who had been intimately involved with the creation of the customs system back in 1275. But here we are now, 20 years later, and the Riccardi are not being mentioned in regards to these new customs duties, and by October 1294, their assets in Ireland, and by implication also their assets in England, were being seized by royal agents. It's not easy to explain why the king moved against the Italians, who'd been one of the mainstays of his financial security. It may be that this banking firm, with its extensive interests in both England and France, suffered so much from the news of an outbreak of war between the two countries that, with a consequent panic of its depositors, it was simply unable to meet any of its obligations. And that does seem to be the root of the problem. They failed to raise a promised tax, in which the Riccardi were asked to act as agents in collecting it, and that was supposedly amounted to about 100,000 marks, or £66,666. And Edward was furious when this money was not gathered, and it seems likely that it was this specific failure which led him to turn against the company which had served him so well for so long. The failure of the Riccardi meant that Edward no longer had the services of Italian bankers ready and willing to supply him with cash. He was, in the autumn of 1294, able to compel 8 companies to lend him a total of 12 grand, probably under threat of expulsion from the realm, and further loans of this type followed. Between 1294 and 1298, he raised a total of almost £29,000 in forced loans from 11 Italian banking companies, but this was hardly an adequate substitute for the wide-ranging assistance which the Riccardi had given him earlier in his reign. Finally, in 1297, the company of the Frescobaldi did lend voluntarily to Edward, but it was not until the king returned from fighting in Flanders in 1298 that they gradually came to occupy a position similar to that held by the Riccardi in the years before 1294. So Edward had to find other means of raising money quickly in the period we're talking about. One method used was commissioners who were appointed to scrutinise all deposits of money in churches and religious houses in England. Now, the supposed reason they did this was to search out counterfeit and clipped coins, But in reality, the king was basically looking for funds and was forcing the church to give him a bit of a loan under threat of violence. A total of £10,795 were removed from private deposits and taken to the treasury. And that's what caused the incident I mentioned last chapter, where the king's agents took a lot of money from St. Paul's, and the shock of it caused the dean of the cathedral to fall over dead from a heart attack. And all of this I've just described, that doesn't actually cover all the methods he used. The sudden crisis of fighting in Wales, followed quickly by fighting in Gascony, followed quickly by fighting in Flanders, followed quickly and simultaneously by fighting in Scotland and Northern England. All of this slammed into the king, and his regime spasmed and schemed to raise money from anywhere and everywhere. And we know this created resentment. We know that the king could say, hey, I need men to fight for me. And there was little objection to sending men to fight in Wales and Scotland. But getting nobles to send men to Gascony, that was much harder and met with more resistance across the country. And also, let's face it, just raising men as it was a costly enterprise. When the Londoners provided 20 men at arms to serve on the coast of Kent in 1296 for just a 4-week period, each man received a generous 20 marks. And in addition to the need for money and manpower, Edward had to collect food for his armies. Now, they did have a system of compulsory purchase called the priests, and that's an old one. And in the past, it had been largely been limited to provision the royal household, and also been used on a small scale in the First Welsh War, and then maybe the Second, and I'll talk about them in a bit. But by the late 1290s, it was greatly extended. In the March and April of 1296, 13,500 quarters of wheat and almost as many oats were demanded from 12 southern counties. And this led to them having that May to point out to the guys requisitioning this that they had to leave enough food so that people didn't starve. These extractions continued throughout 1296, because that July came news from Gascony that the English troops were in severe distress due to lack of food. And in September, they ordered another round, which was 100,000 quarts of grain should be sent over there. In the event, the Exchequer ended up collecting 33 quarters of wheat, 20,400 quarters of oats, 5,800 quarters of barley, and 3,200 quarters of beans and peas. And most of this mostly came from the south and the Midlands. And even though they did try to spread it out, some places got hit more than others. The poor got hit more than the rich. Now, it's not easy to show the degree which these demands from the king affected the people of England. The overall figures of money raised, though, is very impressive. One calculation is that the early stages of the French War, between June 1294 and November 1295, Edward had managed to accumulate and spend some £250,000, probably about a quarter of the total currency of England. At a rough estimate, during the years 1294 to 1297, Edward raised about £150,000 in direct taxation of the people and £130,000 in taxation of the clergy. And you have an idea of how much this impacted people, because the overall assessment figures for taxes from the English people, well, in 1295, they were £81,838, but the following year was £38,484, and in 1297, it was just 35 grand. This suggests that the country's wealth was dramatically reduced. Although it could also be because people got better at persuading and bribing tax assessors to return low figures. But all of this gives an idea of a country being drained of money and of resources to cover three incredibly costly wars. And what were these wars? Well, in a short and brutally brief, honestly, no matter how long I speak, it will not do them justice summary. In Wales, we had the rebellion of Madog ap Llywelyn. This was a nationalist uprising led by a relative of Owain Gwynedd, and it had been planned for months in advance. The result was kind of like a 13th century Welsh Tet Offensive, with joint operations being carried out in the north, south and in mid Wales. The rebels were very well informed. The rebel leaders hoped that by the end of September, King Edward and most of his forces would be in France due to the escalating situation there, so timed their rebellion to happen when he was away. Due to bad weather, however, Edward's army had not yet sailed, and he quickly cancelled the French campaign to deal with the Welsh uprising. And here is where all that talking about Irish sea power, which I did last chapter, comes back to haunt this narrative. You see, in the Southern Irish Sea, as long as there was no navy hostile to England, the Welsh were in deep trouble. Their chances of independence from England depended entirely upon friendly, or at least neutral, sea powers at their back. If English fleets could operate freely in the waters, the Welsh princes had no real means of independence. The English had long known that a frontal attack across Offa's Dyke was a dumb move. The way into the country was via its three coasts. And King Edward had learned this fighting in Wales in the past. I mean, in 1277, that had been when King Edward I had invaded North Wales for the first time, the centre of power of the Welsh prince Llywelyn ap Gruffydd. King Edward established an ample supply depot at Chester, with a fleet of supply ships to bring food from Ireland as well as England to his army, before advancing slowly along the North Welsh coast. He had about 27 large ships doing this, and he clearly appreciated the importance of Anglesey, so not just as an advanced position in the rear of the Welsh, but as a source of grain which fed Snowdonia. And the seaborne force that's sent to occupy the island of Anglesey included 360 reapers to get in harvest. Edward was methodical, and he gained a substantial amount of territory. But this campaign could only operate as long as the fleet was there, and that only operated for the summer. And when the fleet was sent home at the end of September, it was clear that this wasn't enough for him to conquer Wales. So Edward went back again in 1282 on a much bigger scale, and the proof of that was that he had over 40 ships, with at least two of them coming from Ireland. And the basic strategy was the same: cautious advance along the north coast of Wales. But this time, when Anglesey was occupied by a seaborne force, it had a bit more ambition. 14 small ships were brought to support a pontoon bridge across the Menai Strait in order to attack the Welsh at the rear. But that November, the king had got no further than Denby, and the commander of this force attacked prematurely and was heavily defeated. In the retreat, he was killed, and this bridge was broken. Even though Llywelyn was killed in mid-Wales, the king's campaign continued in the north throughout the winter, sustained by large amounts of supplies from Ireland, Gascony and elsewhere. And when Llywelyn's brother Dwyfed was captured the following April, Welsh resistance had finally collapsed. The war demonstrated that in Wales, logistics was the key to victory, and ships were the key to logistics, and the campaign was only possible because there was no hostile fleet in the Irish Sea. But Edward, like most medieval kings, had no idea of the importance of sea power. And you can see absolute proof of this in the concrete magnificence of Edward I's new castle-building programme. In Wales, Edward built the finest castles ever created in British history. Magnificent stone edifices that were basically white elephants and symbols of how little the medieval kings understood how power worked in the British Isles. Lessons learned by later residents that allowed them build an empire. There is no better illustration of English medieval military mind at work than Edward's great fortresses built around North Wales at the end of the Second Welsh War. They still stand as masterpieces of military engineering and were as important and as expensive and as useless as the later Maginot Line. You see, they failed to take on board the importance of the sea. Certainly they all had harbours, but this demonstrated his absolute confidence that he'd always be able to control the sea and no enemy ship would ever interfere them. Simply put, if Edward had any real conception of the flexibility conferred by sea power, he'd never have built a single castle. A medieval castle filled many roles as a symbol of power, a residence, an admin centre, But its military function was simply a force multiplier. You paid a fortune to build one of these big things because, well, it would allow a small force of cavalry dominate a wild district. If an enemy appeared, a well-supplied castle could be defended for months by a small garrison. The besiegers were more likely to be running out of food before those in the castle if it was adequately prepared. But none of this applied in Wales during the Welsh Rebellion. The small cavalry forces were very vulnerable, and you actually needed large bodies of infantry to campaign amongst the forests and mountains. The small garrisons, therefore, were impotent, and the Welsh didn't really bother besieging the castles, not properly. And therefore, the new castles didn't even serve to tie down the enemy. Many of them, as well, were built in quite the wrong place. The west coast castles like Harlech were as far away as they could be from points of strategic importance. Only Conwy Castle could clearly be justified, because it blocked all advance along the north coast and was relatively easily supplied from Chester and from Dublin. The value of the other castles was simply more symbolic or political than military, and the Welsh Rebellion of 1294 revealed this to be true. In December 1294, King Edward led an army into North Wales to quell this revolt, stopping along the way before reaching Conwy Castle, which he got to just before Christmas. But then he was ambushed and retreated to Conwy Castle, losing his baggage train, and the town of Conwy was burnt down, and he was nominally besieged in it until he was relieved by his navy in 1295. There were supposedly besiegements of the other castles, but actually there weren't really. I mean, at one point Harlech was being defended by just 37 men, but it only needed 37 men, and there wasn't really an attack to take it from them. The fighting was everywhere but where the castles were. The actual end of this rebellion came miles away from these somewhat useless things, where the Earl of Warwick surprised Madog's forces over in central Wales, and after a nasty skirmish won by English archers pouring arrows onto the Welsh, so they fled Harum Scarum into a swollen river and lost many from drowning, Madog's number was up and he was soon captured around 1295. And that was the Welsh War. Meanwhile, there was the war with France, which was way more complicated and convoluted. The outbreak of war with France in 1294 was a disaster for King Edward. He didn't want it and tried very hard to go out of his way to stop it from escalating. In May 1293, a high-ranking embassy was sent to Paris to consult Philip IV and to try to arrange a truce. It was headed by Edmund, the Earl of Lancaster, Edward's brother, and Henry de Lacy, the Earl of Lincoln, and by July, a further embassy with greater legal expertise was sent to sort out the fine detail, and that included the Bishop of London. A secret truce was agreed upon, and Edward was delighted, only to find the French went back on their word, sensing in Edward's appeasement weakness, and the war broke out in 1294. This war was the last of a series of 13th century military failures on the continent. It was a complicated and ultimately futile conflict. Edward's strategy was to conduct a holding operation in Gascony while creating a massive alliance of continental princes that could be directed against King Philip. All of this took time to organise, and the Welsh Rebellion in 1294 and 95, followed by the need to act against the Scots in 1296, delayed the full operation of the plan until 1297. Therefore, contrary to what was probably intended, it was in fact in Gascony that most of the military action took place. The campaign that Edward himself led in Flanders in 1297 was remarkably anticlimactic. The full responsibility for defending what was left of the English possessions in southwestern France fell upon what should have been intended as no more than an advance guard, backed up by a bunch of desperate locals. The small expedition which had sailed in October 1294 actually did more than could be hoped for. The mobility of the fleet which carried them down there had enabled the English to move against the French garrisons with surprising speed. The French counterattack came in 1295, when Charles of Valois invaded Gascony with a large army. The English were driven back, quote, like sheep into the fold, unquote. And by the summer of 1295, the English were hard-pressed in Gascony. They held places like Bourg and Blaine, but they were beleaguered and isolated in the north of the duchy, and they held Bayonne and a few outposts in the south, but the rest of Gascony was largely in French hands. This news was doubtless depressing, yet more alarming for the English was the fact that in the summer of 1295, the French began to raid English seaports, and they brought shipbuilders from Genoa to build galleys in Marseille and in Normandy, and, as I mentioned last chapter in 1295, a squadron sailed from the Mediterranean, turned up and attacked the English south coast. However, the king was focused on trying to maintain a war in the north, to gather alliances. There's an incident that the chronicler Peter Langford describes at a council meeting in 1294, in which the action to be taken against King Philip was discussed. When Edward asked for advice, Anthony Beck, the Bishop of Durham, his hatchet man up in Scotland, advocated war in unambiguous terms. Quote, mount the war horses, take your lance in your grip, unquote. And he encouraged the king to buy allies abroad, specifying the King of Germany, the Archbishop of Cologne, the Count of Savoy, the Count of Burgundy, and the King of Aragon. And the barons present all agreed. And as such, over the next few years, we're to see intricate and costly diplomatic manoeuvrings by both the English and the French, as each side tried to construct alliances and counter the other guy's alliances. And it gets really, really dense. Edward wanted to land a force in Flanders, but he had difficulty recruiting an army to go there, as we said, and the force which finally sailed on the 24th of April, 1297, was way too small, consisting of only 895 cavalry and less than 8,000 infantry. Yeah, sure, Henry V was to win the Battle of Agincourt with an even smaller force, but his troops, particularly his archers, were way better equipped than Edward's army was. The English army of 1297 should rather be compared to the one that was going to win the Battle of Falkirk, which was almost 30,000 strong. It was tiny. And not only was Edward's army too small, it was also too late. The French had invaded Flanders and had taken their town of Lille, and Edward therefore arrived to find the war already half lost. Basically, all he could do was turn up, look tough, and negotiate a truce. Agreement was reached in June 1299 and subsequently confirmed by the two kings. In the following September, Edward duly married a woman called Margaret of France to seal the deal, and we'll get to that at another time. The war against France was Edward I's most unsuccessful military venture. The English had not yet developed the tactical skills that were to prove so effective in the hands of Edward III and the Black Prince during the Hundred Years' War. This being said, the Great Alliance of Princes ringing the northern and eastern borders of France was very well put together, and it is unfortunate for Edward that the situation in Scotland should have enabled the French to delay his planned expedition to the continent for so long. And that leads to Scotland, the Third War. So last episode, I covered in detail how Edward's shenanigans with Scotland had led to King John Baliol being seen as little more than Edward's glove puppet. The Scots soon tired of this deeply compromised king, and the direction of affairs in the kingdom was supposedly taken out of his hands by the leading men, who appointed a council of 12, basically in practice a new panel of guardians, in July 1295. It was at their behest, or King John Baliol saying it was at their behest, that after Edward had turned up and demanded troops to aid against the French, they decided to come up with a treaty of mutual assistance with France, an agreement that would eventually be called the Old Alliance, which basically said if England attacked one, the other would join to help them. What was King Edward's response? Well, in the wise words of Marvin the Martian, of course you realise this means war. In retaliation, Edward invaded Scotland and stormed the town of Berwick-upon-Tweed, where he went medieval upon the place. And I mean it. Quote, when the town had been taken in this way and its citizens had submitted, Edward spared no one, whatever the age or sex, and for 2 days streams of blood flowed from the bodies of the slain. For in his tyrannous rage he ordered 7,500 souls of both sexes be massacred so that the mills could be turned by the flow of their blood, unquote. Grim. Edward marched his forces on and defeated a Scottish force at the Battle of Dunbar, and by July 1296, Edward had forced John Baliol to abdicate, and he was now calling himself King of Scotland by right of conquest. And it's at this point we talk about the famous campaign of the young man whose hit-and-run tactics confounded the English as he raised the banners of Scottish independence. Well, we would, but nobody ever made a movie about Andrew de Moray, and so everyone remembers the other guy who rose a smaller force doing the exact same thing. You know, the one who had the support of the Bishop of Glasgow, William Wallace. De Moray and Wallace's forces did enough to cause Edward, who was, as we saw, really busy with stuff in France and Flanders, to send up a bunch of troops. And at the Battle of Stirling Bridge in 1297, the Scots gained a huge victory, helped in no small part by the fact that the bridge, as in Stirling Bridge, collapsed with a shedload of English soldiers on it. Wallace celebrated this victory in proper Scottish fashion and launched a huge invasion of England, burning, pillaging and having way too much fun until his men had to turn back as, seriously, they could not carry any more loot. Wallace was knighted and de Moray and him were appointed as guardians of Scotland and began running it in the name of John Baliol, and we do mean properly running it, and we see them giving trade concessions to merchants from Hamburg. And then on 1298, King Edward and the King of France signed that peace treaty. And all that nonsense in Flanders ended, and the French, when they signed it, didn't say a damn thing about the Scots and kind of left them out to dry. And so Edward decided to come calling, and in July 1298 he invaded Scotland and met the Scots at the Battle of Falkirk, where large numbers of English archers decimated the Scots, and in the aftermath William Wallace resigned as guardian of Scotland and kind of ends up being reduced to diplomatic duties from here on in. But despite this victory, Edward did not win his war in Scotland, and he'd be forced to keep invading the northern country a few more times in the years to come. And yeah, this was the mess we find ourselves in around the year 1300. And while all of this was going on, and because of all of this, London was able to do something totally unexpected and absolutely brilliant. So this is supposedly a podcast about London, so let's ask, while all this was going on, what was London doing? Well, as we mentioned in previous chapters, it was being run directly via two rotating wardens, Warden de Sandwich and Warden Le Breton, and became a place where the supporters of the king could, well, feel safe enough to start showing off. For example, over in Eltham, that village had a manor that was owned by Anthony Beck, the Bishop of Durham, who I mentioned earlier on. In 1296, Beck ordered the construction of a brand new mansion with a moat around it over in Eltham. And this took ages to finish. It was only finished in 1311. And when it was done, he promptly gave it to the king's son, Edward, the Prince of Wales, and it actually became a royal palace, Eltham Palace. In 1297, the new Bishop of Ely, William of Louth, again a close confidant of the king and member of his wardrobe, began improving the grand building he'd inherited from the previous Bishop of Ely. And that was the guy who had placed London under royal control, John de Kirby, and this was the Ely Palace. And it was around this year, 1297, that they completed the private chapel in Ely Palace, which in time became and still is St. Ethelreda's in Ely Place. So it was clear that London was showing signs that those who supported the regime felt very secure in their positions. However, the above wars were, as we said, causing financial difficulties and hardships upon Londoners. And behind all of this was the fact that the king was, again, as we said, basically trying to avoid Parliament being summoned so he would not have to make concessions to anyone. He just wanted to wage his wars and for people to happily give him cash for this. London began to resent this a lot, and we see signs that the wardens of London were worried. In 1297, the warden reissued the curfew order. Now, the curfew had been around in London for a few years, but for reasons, the prohibitions were detailed again in a new order this year. No one was to be found walking the streets after the bell at St. Martin's le Grand had sounded. No taverns were to have their doors open. And when summoned, each citizen was liable to act as watchman. This reissue of the curfew also included other orders. For example, it demanded each citizen should keep the street before his house clean, and that no pigs should roam the streets because, as we know from last episode, itinerant pigs in London were a thing. And also, they went on about making sure there was enough headroom for anything built out of a house, and that ties into the chapter we did a bit ago about the NIMBYs of London. But the basic issuing of the curfew does suggest that in 1297, London was starting to be rebellious. I mean, it is really interesting to note that the king issued an order that forbade the watchmen of London from arresting any priests for rather convoluted reasons. And in the spirit of malicious compliance, London obeyed and then began arresting clerks whom they felt had broken their laws and imprisoning them in the Tun prison in Cornhill. London had watched as King Edward returned to Westminster with the Stone of Scone back in 1296, and in 1297 Edward had a magnificent oak coronation chair made to be placed in the abbey, with the stone symbolically housed beneath it, and it was to remain there for 702 years until it was returned to Scotland in 1999. But fundamentally, in the years 1298 and 1299, the political temperature of London was getting hot. It wasn't alone in the country for feeling this. As we saw from the story I started this chapter with, there, while there were good and partisan supporters of the king, criticism was becoming more extreme and more widespread. Not just in the city, but London was clearly becoming a place that was a focus of it. And at the heart of the national criticism was simply the desire, shared by commoner and clergy, and no doubt several magnates alike, that the king should reissue the Magna Carta and the Charters of the Forest, those old touchstones of the liberty in the realm, the rules his grandfather John and his father Henry had agreed to. And the king did promise to reissue them in 1298. But when a parliament was held in March 1299, there was much argument over the proposed confirmation of the Charters of the Forest. The king prevaricated in a most unsatisfactory manner, but when pressed hard, he announced that he would give an answer on the next day, and instead of doing so, he left London in secret. The story goes that the Earls of Parliament, apparently with a mob of Londoners with them, went after the king, wondering what the hell he was doing. King Edward excused his conduct, saying that the foul air of London was damaging his health, and promised that if you return to London, I'll send the council an answer. When it came, the answer was far from satisfactory. What the king produced on the 2nd of April was a statute known as the De Finibus Libertas. It made it clear that the king was not prepared to confirm the Charter of the Forest in its entirety. He was basically not wanting to give away any political concessions, and the earls and their followers departed from London in absolute fury. All of this led to the State Council and the wardens fearing riots in the city. In fact, we think they did more than just fear them, they had to deal with them. We have reports in 1299 that a large mob suddenly descended upon the Tun prison, the new jail, the one built for social criminals, but was actually a symbol of the regime of the wardens of London. And it was an iconic symbol of the king's reign. Now, the mob, I've read in some sources, were there to release prisoners inside, and I've read other sources to say that the mob was there to destroy the building, to which I have to say on behalf of those angry Londoners, why not both? Something clearly needed to be done, and we know sometime around now the wardens had the Forest Charter and the Magna Carta read aloud in St. Paul's Churchyard, and for many Londoners this sounded like, hey, they're reading it aloud, that means the king's agreed to live by them. But any initial delight turned to dismay when it became clear the king was not keeping his word on this matter. And, well, maybe this is what caused the mob to attack the Tun. London, again, wasn't alone in fury at the king over this. Just over a week later, a new parliament was summoned to meet in May in a fresh attempt to resolve the situation. But it is now that London managed to pull what is, in my opinion, the best blag of the 13th century. See, with all of this going on, the wily old London oligarchs had an idea. and it appears that quietly they were led by Henry de Wales. Remember him? Many-time mayor of London and a veteran London politico. He'd been mayor before Gregory de Rooksy had taken the position from him and held it up to the incident that had caused London to lose its mayors. So, Henry de Wales looked around. Here was England, with all these wars and all these costs. And sure, the war in Wales and in France was over, but the Scottish were still fighting. The king still needed to raise money. Everybody was shouting at him. They wanted him to give concessions to Parliament before he could get the money. He was not willing to do that. There were riots going on, and no one likes riots. And I can imagine that Welsh mine merchant turned London oligarch, Henry de Wales, quietly, along with a bunch of fellow leading men of London, travelling quietly and discreetly down to Westminster and basically saying, "Your Majesty, why don't we take the sting out of the fever in London and do so in a way that'll raise you a bit of cash? Because if we paid you enough, maybe you could, you know, restore the position of mayor." And guess what? King Edward took the bait. And the long-running dispute of London was ended, and the city's liberties were formally confirmed. After a 13-year hiatus, London got its mayor back, and wily old Henry de Wales was restored to the position of mayor for the fifth time. And somehow, after 13 years, London had blagged their way back to regaining a mayor as they entered the 14th century. For all of his faults, de Wales has to be judged in the light of this one act. He'd managed to get the mayors of London restored, which was, in no uncertain terms, the greatest blag of 1299. Well done, my son. And I'm going to leave it there. Thank you for listening. I will see you next week for another chapter in the story of London as we come towards the end of the reign of King Edward. And then his son takes over. And then it gets really interesting. All right. Cheers.